accession number 19932, reel 2.
John Bennett, reel 2.
From the reinforcement unit, all troops were sent to the battle school at Haramura, which was the Japanese Imperial Guard's training ground prior to the Second World War. And there we came under the command of an English commonly known as the Mad Major, who took great delight in walking in front of the firing mound, and somehow he led a charmed life that he could walk between, he'd give the command to fire and step between the targets, until one day some Australian put a hole through the crease of his trousers, and I understand he ended that. But he's well known as a Mad Major.
What was the name of this place?
This was at Haramura. I don't know the Major's name. He's commonly known as the Mad Major. It was a 30-mile route march to get down, 30 miles back. So it was a long way. It was uphill most of the way through the villages. I was lucky I went up by jeep and I came back by jeep because I suddenly wanted sergeants in Korea. But the battle school was honing people up at the last minute firing, night practice with crawling under barbed wire with machine guns above your head, live firing exercises, and generally to get your nerves in shape, I'd imagine. We never thought much of it. It was a great excitement at that time. From there, back to the reinforcement holding unit, catch a plane to Korea, and I arrived at Kimpo Airport about 7:30 in the morning, to be meted by this chap I mentioned earlier, Jack Galloway, who'd heard I was coming somehow, and he was greeting me. It was a cold, very cold morning, and greeted me with a bottle of beer, which was the last thing you want first thing in the morning. So then there was a all-day drive up to the front line, even though it was only 30 or 40 miles away from Kimpo Airport. Took all day with the traffic on the road, passing through villages. In that time, there were still trucks and tanks turned over on the side of the road as a result of earlier battles. Arrived at battalion headquarters at probably 5 o'clock at night. A bit too late to do anything other than sit in a hole all night until you could be allocated to the platoons next day. And I was posted to a platoon called 12 Platoon Don Company as a platoon sergeant.
What impression did you get of them at first?
Well, I still had a lot of confidence in myself. You know, I thought I was one of the, you know, the army really depended on me. And the platoon sergeant at the time was a DCM winner, a guy by the name of Rollinson, Bill Rollinson, who, I'm pretty sure he got two DCMs in the end, but taking over from an established, demonstrated, brave sergeant was very difficult from a rookie that's never seen a shot fired in anger. So I had a few problems with the platoon. You know, a lot of the guys had been through Operation Commando, which was still going on at that stage, mainly because I was inexperienced and they relied on me, the sergeant, Rollinson at the time. But I was lucky in some ways that a lot of those guys, probably half the platoon in, were due for rotation, and a new batch came in who were people I knew from the training, Haramura or from Pakapunyal. So they were also in the same boat as I was. You know, we had half the platoon who were experienced and the other half people like myself who were not experienced. The officer in charge was a guy called Young. I didn't particularly like him, but he was only there for a couple of days, probably maybe a week at the most, before he moved on. And he ended up with a sticky end anyway. He came back to Australia, and he was one of those few officers dismissed from the army court-martial for kicking a man on the rifle range, jumping on him and kicking him. He was dismissed from the army. There's something about him I didn't particularly like. But the new officer was a guy I'd had a lot of time, had done time with in Australia, a guy by the name of Robin Hone. And commonly known as Guts and Gaiters because of his size. He was all belly and his gaiters ran halfway up his legs. But he had been in the Second World War, but towards the end of the war. But he didn't have a great deal of experience, but he turned out to be an excellent officer in many, many ways. And I got to, you know, I really liked him as a person. We had no, had a very strict lines of communication. He was always Sir or Skipper. There was no first name basis, as I guess there is, I understand there is nowadays more of a first name basis. But in those days, it was fairly rigid. The regular army and address the officers by Sir or Skipper, not by Joe or whatever the Christian names happen to be. So I settled down to life in the lines.
What was that like? What were living conditions like?
I had no problems at all early in the piece. I guess Don Company and 12 Platoon were in reserve while the rest of the battles were going on, Operation Commando. It was a day-to-day changing situation. It was a very fluid situation. I mean, the first patrol I had to do was an ambush patrol. One night, Chinese had crept through the lines between 227, which was a prominent feature, and I'll come to it later on. And I had to go down, see if I can get the bodies out of the minefield. There were three of them killed. Two bodies were still in the minefield. So I went down, and I guess I wasn't very smart when you knew the damage mines could do. But I could see the wires, and I stepped over the wires to see if I can get this, lift this body out. But he was draped over another wire. And I thought, well, this is just not on. So I tippy-toed back out of the minefield and made a reconnaissance where we'd put an ambush patrol in that night. Later that night, I took the ambush patrol out, but we didn't. Nobody else came through that way. It was interesting in that they did recover the body from the minefield and took it across the valley to the Chinese lines for where they could recover the body, and nobody fired on them. You know, they did respect, there was that respect that the Chinese would allow the bodies to be returned and you to recover the wounded. And I think that was a big plus, that when you hear what's happened in later wars, there's some chivalry, I guess. That. So that was my first first patrol.
And then?
It was a period of the peace talks had got underway, and the peace talks were to run until December. And at that time, there was you weren't to take ground, either side weren't to take ground from the other side, from understanding. So there were no active attacks on features as such, but there's a fairly active patrolling. The Australian patrol very actively, I think that was well established. And we went back into the line in early January took over from the Canadians and went back into the line in January. And the first big raid we did was 227 when I was a platoon sergeant on that. And that's one of the reasons I came to London this, or one of the other reasons I came to London this time, to find out more information on the raids by reading the KSLI war record and 28th Brigade war diary. Because I always felt that 227 remained, was never ever taken from the Chinese, and yet so many people lost their lives defending something that couldn't be held. Even till the last days of the war, when 15 British soldiers were killed in one incident, it made me wonder, you know, the futility of trying to take this particular feature. And,
who was occupying 227 in January?
The KSLI were thrown off on early January, and the Chinese took it again. The KSLI lost something like 30 men trying to defend the hill. It was clearly that the Chinese wanted to keep the feature. When the KSLI lost the feature, it was decided the Australians would go and try and re-establish their position on the hill. And the raiding party that I was in, that was our attempt to hold the hill, which was most unsuccessful. we lost 6 killed and 9 wounded, or 7 killed and 9 wounded in the whole episode.
Were you on that attempt?
Yes, I was a sergeant.
Can you take me through it, step by step, what you remember of it, please?
Well, I've had my memory refreshed. Well, I've always remembered it because it's sort of seared in my mind over the years, and I guess it's one of the reasons I got out of the army. apart from realising, I guess, that I probably would never make this gung-ho combatant soldier that rushes up and sticks his knife into somebody who cuts his throat. I mean, it wasn't for me. But going up the hill, it was a well-planned operation. They had a searchlight on the hill all night. The problem with the searchlight was that depressions in the ground could be 6 inches deep or they could be 6 feet. You could never tell. And the target was softened up fairly considerably by 15 minutes bombardment. As soon as the artillery stopped, we attacked the hill. 2 sections forward, then the officer, and my section coming up. There's the officer. The officer must have been behind the first section, and I was in the third section, which is a standard procedure. The officer goes up and the sergeant comes behind. Except in retreat or when you withdraw, it's the other way around. The officer goes first. So the first section commander got killed as soon as he got on top of the hill. And there's a fierce fight for probably 15 minutes. The 2 sections were on the west side, and I went round to, swung my section round to the east side. And unfortunately, there's a Chinese with a burp gun, and he stood up, and between myself and the 3 guys, they were all killed or wounded. Somebody threw a phosphorus grenade at him, the Chinese. He picked it up. He stopped firing by that time. I must have been bewildered. I forget what I did then. He threw it out again, and then the Australian picked it up and threw it back in and exploded in the trench, and the Royal Chow was burned to death, I'd imagine. Or he disappeared down the hole. We didn't, never followed him up. And then it settled down for a couple of hours. We started, the reserve platoon came up. Initially they were to bring some timbers up to form a bunker, but we'd had so many casualties at this stage they decided that the troops would not bring up the timber but withdraw the wounded and the dead. And I didn't realise until I went back to Korea 2 years ago that one of the people on the stretcher bearers, his name was also Bennett, he'd come up and he knew more about the casualties than I did as a platoon sergeant. I mean, so much was happening around you all the time. Well, we sent a listening party. Once it settled down, there was a lot of firing for a while, and they started to range in with mortars and artillery. But we sent a two listening posts down to the north of the feature, where in fact I think we should have sent them to the west, but this was in the confusion at the time. And for about 2 hours we were bombarded with artillery and mortar. But fortunately, we're in the positions dug by the KSLI some when they occupied the hill. Even though most of them were collapsed, they were still offered some shelter. And the Chinese were forming up at that time for an attack on us. We didn't know this. We sensed that it was something happening, because when it was all quiet, it was a bit uncanny, you know, and our artillery was still firing at various positions, the Chinese positions. The position suddenly got worse. I forget all the times I've got them down there. Position got worse after about 9 o'clock, I think. We went up at 7. And there's a good hour when things settled down and the stretcher bearers could come up and take the wounded away. And I took one of the corporals. By this time we'd lost two corporals. We only had one corporal left. So other guys had to step into those positions. I remember taking the corporal down, and then coming up the hill, and when I came up the hill, I said, what the F am I here for? This is ridiculous, you know, that people have been killed left, right and centre, and I remained unscathed, you know. The three guys in my section were shot dead beside me. I seem to be living a charmed life at this stage. So I imagine when I went back after dropping the wounded corporal, I said, this is crazy, you know, we're in for a hiding. You're thin on the ground, and we've got a huge hill, and by that time we're down to almost half the platoon of 30 men. There might have been 15 of us left. And keep getting radio contact. We wondered if the second platoon was going to come up and reinforce us, but decisions were being made by the CO that they wouldn't reinforce us. And I guess it was around about 10 o'clock at night, when I look at the diaries, we start to hear the whistles and the bugles. The Chinese were mashing for an attack on us. And they start firing a heavy machine gun onto the hill. The pinnacle of the hill, they were missing us. It was going above our head by God knows what height, but the tracer's directly in line above us, but we were down several feet lower than that. So the gunfire was ineffective. They were hitting at the top of the hill and we were down probably 10 or 15 feet below that. But the mortars were also missing us. You know, we were leading a charmed life. But then we they're forming up in two places to attack us. There was a battalion. There were a battalion strength attack by the Chinese on us, coming from the west side. Now, we were facing the north, tended to have our defences facing the north, and the platoon commander then decided it was time for the CO to make his decision as to whether we're going to reinforce us or withdraw us. And he got the order to withdraw as soon as we were able to disentangle ourselves from the Chinese. So then he called on me to go down and bring back the listening post that we had at north of the position. And I tell you what, I was really terrified, you know. All hell was breaking loose, and instead of being the brave sergeant standing up, the officer was the guy who was the steadiest of all of us. I wasn't panicking, but inwardly I was trying to, you know, make sure I did a very good job, but feeling quite incapable of it. And he said, well, go down and bring the guys back. And I said, fine. At least you had to do something. There's nothing worse than standing around waiting for an attack. You can hear the stuff coming in. You can't see it. You can't see the enemy, but you hear all the noise, the bugles, the flares going up all over the place. So I just got to the top of the embankment, and two things happened. One, supposedly a Chinese stood up fairly close to me and let fly, which he didn't hit me, but the platoon opened fire on him and killed him. And then a drop short, when the only one of the night, according to the officer, hit the hill behind me, behind us, and that was enough to blow me down the hill. So I go tumbling down the hill to through the barbed wire, lost a lot of my clothes from the legs up, and managed to find where the listening post was by calling out to them and got them back to the hill. But all fear had then gone. I was no longer frightened. It was just a momentarily, God, you know, I've got to go down. Where are they? I didn't even know where they were. And one of the guys in the listening post was an Aboriginal who became quite prominent later on in Vietnam, a guy by the name of Massa Clark. But once we reassembled, then we waited then for the order to abandon the hill, which we did. I can't remember fighting our way out, although the war Doris said we did. We had carried all the wounded and dead by this time had been taken off the hill, and it disturbed me many years later to find out that a body had been left on the hill, and when two stretcher bearers went to get it, they were both killed. But it turned out that it wasn't on the pinnacle, the top of the hill itself, but more on one of the outposts we had lower. It wasn't my platoon at all, because I was the last man off the hill, and I had to check that, you know, the whole platoon had gone, or what remained of us. And so I was always conscious that I knew there was nobody there. And after a while, I wasn't sure that there was nobody left behind. And seemingly, later in the battle, we left about 1 o'clock in the morning. We passed through an outpost, and it was the outpost that where the body was left behind. And when I went to recover it, the Chinese shot the stretcher bearers. And that was the first... And it's more by accident, I think, that rather than by design, because they did respect people removing the wounded.
Was it easy to make a mistake like that?
Pardon?
Was it easy to make a mistake like that?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Easily. I mean, if it was me, I wouldn't be wondering whether... Unless you actually saw a person bending over a body, you wouldn't be thinking twice. I mean... The adrenaline's going, anybody's moving as a potential enemy is likely to kill you. So we went back to, finally went back to our position, which was a rear position, and 3 o'clock in the morning, and I guess for a day or two you're on a high, but I'd been deafened by the blast and still have a war disability through loss of hearing.
Before you went into this battle on this hill, do you remember what kind of a briefing that you got before you went?
Yes, we were well briefed, or the commander, the skipper, the platoon commander was well briefed on it. He then briefed me as to the plan. But he was very much in control of what was going on. He would direct it from where he was up the front, and... I just fill in the gaps. But as far as briefing, all the section leaders were briefed on what they had to do. And we had three very experienced section leaders.
Do you remember what the plan was as he described it?
The first two sections were to clear the hill and fan out onto the west side. The third section was to come up and go around to the east side. And the first two sections achieved that objective, but there was a Chinese hiding in one of the bunkers, or a couple of Chinese, and they caused the havoc with killing the leader. But the other sections carried on. I guess that's one of the things we're very happy with the Australians, that everybody sort of knew what their role was within the section. We'd practice together, not this particular raid, but we'd we had a lot of teamwork that is always there. Somebody drops the gun, number two picks it up, and somebody steps into his place. And that was well disciplined into us.
Through training?
Through training. And through experience. You become experienced very, very quickly too, of course. But it's mainly through training that everybody knew his role. The number two on the Bren knew what he had to do, and if the Bren gunner got hit, the number two took over, or somebody else took over. We were never short of people to fill the different roles within the platoon. And the commander was good. The commander was a very calm individual.
I was interested in what you said about who goes first, whether it's the NCO or the officer.
No. The whole section, which was the NCO, the corporal, he went up the first section, and then the officer came between those two, which would say the two fighting sections, well, they were all fighting sections. But because it was the pinnacle of the hill, we couldn't attack it in an extended line. You had to go up in single file, and that made it much more difficult for where to place the officer. Clearly, he couldn't be in the front, and he's best in between the two sections.
Why is that?
Well, it was single file. You don't know what minefields were on either side of the track to get to the pinnacle, the top of the hill. It's far better the officer to be behind the first section rather than up in front. I mean, if the officer was lost, all was lost in many ways, because he was the key. He knew the CO's plan. He knew what the CO wanted to do. I knew what the platoon commander wanted to do. I didn't know what the CO wanted to do. It wasn't a need-to-know exercise rather than if you need to know, you'll be told. And we didn't query that.
Was that in case you were captured?
Pardon?
In case you were captured?
No, I don't think that. We never thought we'd ever be captured. We were going to live forever. Which soon found out that we weren't.
And this Chinese who stood up that you described, who eventually got burned?
I never saw, in the first instance. It was only gunfire coming from a hole, and then somebody threw the phosphorus at him. He stopped firing to get rid of the phosphorus, threw it out, and the guy picked it up again and threw it back in the hole again. And there was a loud woof, and unfortunately, when the phosphorus goes off, you lose your night sight, which is a bit of a pain in the neck or pain in the eye. You can't see for a few minutes, and what happened after that, we don't know.
What did you think of that Chinese and the way he performed?
Oh, he was pretty brave. I mean, he'd waited until two sections had gone past him. There must have been at least two on the hill.